you like?
Michael Hinton, retired teacher, retired priest.
Thank you, Mr. Hinton. Can you tell me a little bit about yourself, your home background, parents and schooling?
Yes. I was born in Bristol in 1927. My father was a schoolmaster, my mother was a nurse. My mother gave up full-time nursing when she got married, but carried on a part-time basis. I went to Bristol Grammar School Prep School, and then to Bristol Grammar School. I had a rather disrupted secondary education because it was during the Second World War, and of course Bristol was bombed quite heavily. My mother died in 1940, and we were looked after by a housekeeper after that. I had a very happy time at Bristol Grammar School, especially the latter years there. And in 1945, I went up to Merton College with a postmastership, 3 years at Merton, and then a year at the Institute of Education in London. And after that, I went into teaching.
So did you know you wanted to be a teacher right from the very beginning?
Well, apart from a few childish fantasies, yes. Yes, I wanted to be a head from the very beginning, to
really?
Be honest. Yeah.
What inspired you to do that?
Well, it wasn't my father, because I think, if anything, he exercised his influence in the other direction. I think it was that I was so happy at Bristol Grammar School, and I couldn't imagine anything I'd rather do than be head of a grammar school.
And you chose history for your major degree?
Well, I'm not sure if I chose history or if my headmaster told me that I was going to do history at university. A bit of both, I think. Things were much more directive in those days. I was good at English and history, and I think my headmaster probably told me that I ought to do the history, and that's how it happened.
Can you remember anything about how you were taught history at Bristol Grammar School?
Well, I can remember quite a little bit about both prep school and the grammar school. At prep school, we started at 55 BC every year and got as far as we could. And at the grammar school, we had a most wonderful history teacher called Punch. That was his nickname, Punch Roberts. But all he used to do was to come in, sit on a desk and yarn to us. And we got the romance of history from him. But of course, he didn't use anything other than essays and notes for his techniques. I can remember that he allowed me to give a lecture on the Peninsular War once, but that was a very unusual thing that we digressed from the normal talk and chalk. And the history I was taught was really Sellers and Yeatman, 1066 and all that, you know, all the way through.
So you became a history teacher?
Yep.
How did you learn to teach history at the Institute?
They were a sort of cutting edge for history teaching in those days, with ideas about projects and visual aids and history activities. And I got myself quite unpopular by opposing all that while I was there.
This is the early 1950s?
Yes, it was 1948, 49 I was there. I was a very reactionary in my attitude to it, but as soon as I went into teaching, I borrowed the ideas wholesale and did everything that they'd suggested one should do.
Did you think that was because of your Bristol Grammar School inheritance that you were...
Well, no, I got a very highfalutin idea about history from university, and I want to say quite a bit more about that later on. But I soon discovered that when you're actually in the classroom, if you want to do something enterprising, you really have to vary your methods a great deal more than the methods by which I'd been taught.
And can you say a bit more about what the Institute were recommending you do in the classroom?
It was most, I think, projects were the great thing in those days, but visual aids was the other great thing, that you shouldn't just use textbooks and use talk. Beyond that, I can't remember very much, quite frankly.
So visual aids, they meant posters and maps on the wall,
that sort of thing, yes. Yes. But, as I say, projects were the great idea.
So what would a project constitute?
Well, you'd take some theme like a war, or you'd take some social phenomenon, and you'd write about it and illustrate it, and you do some research about it, And of course, research was much more difficult in the days before the internet.
Mm.
So it was a way of teaching you to use books. And of course, it gave you the chance to draw and to make a work of art that you could be pleased with.
So this would appeal to a wider range of children.
Well, I think that was probably the idea, yes.
So when you actually got into the classroom, how long did it take you to become confident and start using some of these new ideas?
My first job was at Reading School, which was a grammar school. It was a state grammar school, but it was very like a public school. In fact, I think it was actually on the headmaster's conference, or had been. And it was the easiest school I ever taught in. And I can remember asking the head of history some question when I went there, and he said, "Hinton, I teach as I see fit, you teach as you see fit, we have nothing to say to each other." And that was it. Each teacher was king of his classroom and taught as he saw fit. And that actually helped me enormously, because I was able to do things that my colleagues would have shrunk from doing. So,
but you were fortunately confident enough to do it. If you hadn't have been...
I was a very brash young man, and I was quite happy to try things out. The most famous thing I did, which we actually got an article in the school magazine, was to make a film strip. That was thought to be the last level of sophistication at that time, to get a class to make a film strip.
And you had the equipment in school to do that?
Well, I was friendly with the art master, and he helped me do it, yes.
And what was it about, can you remember?
The Navy during the Napoleonic Wars.
And did the children actually go out and about and or just create?
They drew pictures to make, and maps and so on, to make the film strip, which I haven't got any longer, I'm afraid.
But it didn't include photographs of places?
No, not photographs, it was all drawings.
And how did you use it once they'd done it?
I don't think it was used very much. I think it was the making of it that was the... I may have used it with classes a little bit after that, but it was the actual making of it that was the fun, and which made an impression, I think.
And when they... Was it boys and girls?
It was a boys' school.
Boys' school. When the boys were making the film strip, were they also researching the background?
Oh, yes, they were doing a bit of research and so on. I can't remember what books they used. But they were a very lively lot at Reading School. It was a very high quality entry. So it was good fun. But
what age were the boys who were doing the film strip?
I think, if I remember rightly, they were third year. Once you got onto the, once you got into the GCS, well, as school certificate as it was then, things were a bit more serious.
You would be teaching them school certificate at that time, would you?
Yes.
So it was before O-level.
Oh yes, well before O-level, yes.
So the boys, when they got into fourth and fifth form, how many subjects would they be taking?
About eight.
Really?
Yes.
And history would normally be one of those?
Normally be one of them, yes.
Yes, it wasn't a matter of options?
Not to my recollection, but I couldn't be certain about that.
And then, did you actually have any doubts about the way you were teaching? Or did it all work successfully?
Well, everything seemed to work very well. I mean, of course, most of my teaching was still oral, talk and chalk. But I tried this experiment and probably others which I can't now remember. And it was very nice to be allowed my head. And I did things like starting a history society in the school and that kind of thing. And I was a medievalist at Oxford. And I was given an A-level medieval history set, which was tremendous fun, and which I think some of my ex-pupils still remember with affection, which is very nice.
It is. You hear from them?
Yes, when I wrote the 100-Minute Bible, my name got out of it, and quite a lot of them got in touch with me, which
That's
was lovely.
Wonderful.
Hmm.
So how did you conduct your medieval history A-level class?
Well, I wanted to say something in general about sixth form teaching. I think university history teaching at the time I did it was basically training you to be a member of the administrative civil service in the sense that what you learned was to manipulate material, to write persuasive essays about it. We used to say that the job of the historian at university was to reach the right conclusions on insufficient evidence. And basically that's the same job as a civil servant, we thought. And I think what you were taught was dexterity of mind, clarity of expression, the ability to sort out material and drop what wasn't relevant and that kind of thing. And I think it was a mental training, that it was almost incidental that it was history. And to a degree I took that attitude into sixth form teaching. I tried to conduct it on a basis of sort of seminar basis. I tried to teach them how to take notes without having notes dictated to them. I made them write an awful lot of essays. And it was really a watered-down university teaching.
So you expected them for the seminar to go away and research a topic and then come and present it in the class?
Yes, that was one of the things we did. And another thing, I'd learnt that at school because we had a very brilliant English teacher who got us to do that kind of thing. And really what I was trying to do was to make them think all the time. In a way, it wasn't the best way to teach them to pass examinations, but it was the best way, I thought, to give them an education. They had to discuss, I made them discuss things, and you know, the saying that the royalists were right but wrong but romantic, and the roundheads were right but repulsive, that sort of discuss that kind of thing, you know. And I think it was an intellectual training, I saw it as that.
And were the results good?
The results at Reading were good. The results at Lancaster, where I went next, were good, apart from one year when I was taken out badly caught out by the English examination, the examination in English history. But other than that, they were good.
So you were at Reading for how many years?
4 years.
So that's till 1952?
1953.
And then you went to Lancaster?
No, sorry, 1954 I was. Then I went to Lancaster Royal Grammar School as the head of history.
So that was a logical next step,
yes,
for a successful,
right,
young,
yes,
history teacher.
That's right, yes.
So thinking back to those days in the classroom, what topics of history or kind of history did you enjoy teaching?
Well, I'm afraid I was always a great one for battles. I loved military history. And I think the period that I probably enjoyed teaching most of all was the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars. And the fact that I did my PhD in that period, of course, confirmed my interest in it. I remember very vividly when I was doing my teaching practice, I was at Hackney Downs Grammar School, which was quite a well-known school in those days. It later had tragic history. But I had a very sticky C class there, bottom stream, and I had a lot of problems with them until one lesson I taught them about what a 16th century ship was like, with drawings and so on. And they were absolutely rapt by it, and I thought, well, if you get the right topic, you can get the interest even of quite disruptive classes. So that was a useful lesson for me.
Did you have any disruptive classes, either at Reading or at Lancaster?
No, I mean, you really, if you were confident and on top of your subject, you weren't going to have problems in that kind of grammar school. No, any problems I ever had with disruptive classes came when I was at comprehensive school later on.
So could you tell me a bit about Lancaster? How many years were you at Lancaster, and was it a different experience to Reading or very similar?
It was, yes. It was also an HMC school with boarders. But it was a local authority grammar school. It was a bit more rough and ready than Reading. A little bit more difficult to teach in, but not much. And I had a very sympathetic headmaster, a great man, I thought at the time. And I was appointed because the history department had collapsed, really. The person who was running it previously had lost interest, and I had to try and resuscitate it. And it was very easily done, because you just had to teach the boys competently and they would respond. And I still remember, I constructed the history syllabus in about half an hour. I just sat down and divided English history into chunks, and we taught English history in these chunks.
What were the chunks? Were they periods?
They were periods, yes, that's what I mean, yes. We started off, I can't think why we did the second of these things, but we started off by doing the history of the school, And then, for some reason, the Siege of Troy. I just cannot remember now why I decided to do that, but I think I had to fill a little hole at the beginning of the course, and I decided that would do it. And then we just went through the periods sequentially.
And so what did you start? Did you start with the Norman Conquest or earlier than that?
I can't remember for sure, but I think it was probably with the Norman Conquest. We didn't. I don't think we went back to the Romans, no. No. And I think we used C.P. Hill as the textbook. That was the standard textbook at the time. I knew C.P. Hill. He was a great man, actually. And his textbooks were excellent. And I think that was the standard textbook we used.
And then that was for the first 3 years you were devising the syllabus, and then the boys started their O-level syllabus, did they, after that?
I had to decide all the way through. Mm. It's a shameful thing to say. I can't remember what period we did for O level, but I imagine it was 19. Yes, I can. I can remember. It was 19th and 20th centuries. We just did the earlier centuries, the first years, and the later centuries at the end. And I made a great thing of teaching people how to take notes methodically and sensibly, without dictating them to them, because I thought that was. I once lost the chance of getting a job because I told a senior history teacher that dictated notes with the abomination of desolation, and he said, oh, I do all my teaching through dictated notes. That was at Malvern College when I was looking for my first job.
That's one of those moments when you wish the earth opens and
no, I think, yes, at the time I was a bit sad, but I'm deeply glad I didn't get into that particular culture, actually, deeply glad.
And did you start from age 11 and 12 to teach them how to make notes?
I think so, yes. I think that all the way through. I do think it's a terribly important skill. Mm. And and of course, the other thing was to teach them how to write essays. And I had a letter recently from a chap who's now a professor, a retired professor, who was one of the ablest boys I taught. And he was quoting back to me what I'd told him about essay writing. So I obviously did him some good.
So this was all done with you talking at the front of the class and explaining on the board. You didn't have any reproduced materials?
No, reproduction didn't come in as a feasible possibility really at all at that stage. What I did do at Lancaster was to have a history library in my room, which had a great variety of books in it. The sixth formers didn't just use one textbook, which is what I had done when I was at school. Whereas two textbooks, one English and one European. They had a variety of books to use, textbooks to use, and I had a lot of other books. There was a series which gave you all sorts of practical things like history of ships, history of bells, history of cannon, you know, that sort of with pictures in them. And we used to use those a bit in for projects and that kind of thing. So I tried to enlarge their experience.
How did you find the reaction of other teachers in the school? Were they taking on board some of your ideas and adopting them, or did they just say, that's Hinton's thing, we'll do our own thing?
At Lancaster, I think there was a greater attempt for us to teach analogously. When I went there, the other two history teachers were, well, one of them was the chap who'd made a mess of things. Fortunately, he left a year later. And the other was a very antique chap who wasn't going to change at all. But some new people were appointed while I was there. And we did work much more closely together. But still, of course, king of the classroom was your king in your classroom was the main thing. All that mattered was that you kept order and got good results.
Can you remember what were the least enjoyable things you had to teach in history?
I can't remember hating anything, no. Because, of course, I was choosing what I was teaching to a large degree.
Yes.
One thing I did at Lancaster, which I think stood me in very good stead when we had a general inspection, was I introduced the teaching of the history of science. We had a pretty strong sixth form general studies programme, and I did it in that. And that was very enjoyable. I think the boys liked it, and I certainly enjoyed it very much indeed. And that was a nice digression from the normal topics.
Did you find it easy to get the materials to teach the history of science?
Well, I used three or four books. There was Hull, History of Science. There was Didn't Butterfield write a book about Herbert Butterfield? I'm not sure.
I'll try to find it.
I can't remember the other ones, but there were three or four books. Oh, yes, James Jeans, I think, wrote a history of... I'm sorry to be doubtful about it.
It's not that important. No. We can move on.
And the another thing I was very, very keen on was what you might call the theory of history, and we used to, in general studies or to some degree in history classes, do things like read Butterfield, The Whig Interpretation of History, and that kind of thing. And I was trying to make them think about what history involved as not so much regarded as context, but what it was all about, what history was trying to teach us and what we could learn from it in a general way, and how we manipulate the past in order to manage it, you know, and understand it and that kind of thing.
Did you ever do trips with the boys out of school to historical sites?
No, I don't think so, not at all. No, that didn't happen till I was at comprehensive school.
So perhaps we should move on to the next stage of your career. When did you leave Lancaster?
1960, I went as head to the grammar school here in Dover, and I was a very young head, so I left my staff very much to teach as they saw fit. But I remember that the history teacher, who was a very interesting man in the head of history, a very volcanic man, and very fierce disciplinarian, he decided that he would teach some Chinese history and I think some Persian history or something like that. He wanted to be radical while I was there. So, of course, it was still talk and chalk. They didn't do just English history, they did something else. Other than that, I didn't have any influence on the history teaching there. But by that time, I was a senior examiner, so I was having quite an influence on what was set in the A-level English history for Cambridge.
Shall we talk about the examination side of things now? How did you become involved in examination work?
When I was at Lancaster, I was determined, very much wanted to get some exam work because I needed the money. And fortunately at that stage, C.P. Hill, who'd been head of history at Bristol Grammar School, got in touch and said, would you like to examine for Cambridge A-level? So I examined for Cambridge A-level. I nearly got the sack because I was far too fierce with my marking, and I had to be very severely rebuked and remarked texts and all sorts. But eventually I was accepted as an examiner, and I eventually became chief examiner. And that was good fun, really, because it meant setting the papers and that kind of thing. And really, I suppose what I was trying to do there was to create papers which reflected my own view of what history should be as a method of thinking and a way of learning to form sensible opinions about the past and so on. But it wasn't entirely successful, of course, because even at A-level an awful lot of the children have been taught by rote, and the number of essays I marked, which began when Richard III lost his crown at the Battle of Bosworth. You know, that was the sort of standard way in which they didn't, an awful lot of them weren't capable of using the material, they just reproduced it and regurgitated it. But there were lots of who did the better thing.
When you say you were introducing questions which tried to explore the extent to which students had been thinking, how did those questions differ from what had been set before?
I don't think they did differ very much. I mean, I think the Cambridge exam was a very enlightened exam. I think I was following in the footsteps of C.P. Hill. But what was unusual in the Cambridge English paper, English history paper, was to set a question which you could just do by reproducing your what your teacher had taught you. You know, we tried to make them think. And obviously, if they'd been well taught, some of the opinions they'd need would have arisen in the course. But the idea was that it was a test of the use of material, and not just a test of material.
But When you say use of material, you're meaning the knowledge that they'd learned, are you, as opposed to sources and documents?
There was, yes, this is one of the huge differences between history as I taught it and as Christopher teaches it, taught it. We didn't use original sources very much at all. It was nearly all based on what you could get out of textbooks. And in a sense, what we were doing was testing the use of those textbooks. I knew which textbooks the boys and girls would be using, and I knew what sort of responses I would get from them because I knew which textbooks they were using. And I can remember one year when a textbook had recently come out which had a new view about, I think it was Queen Mary, and I half the papers that I marked about Mary said one thing and the other half said the other. You know, one had been using the old textbook, one had been using the new one.
How did you decide who was right?
I gave equal marks to both of them because it wasn't their responsibility. Their teacher hadn't got the new textbook.
During the 1960s, even though you were ahead at that time, were you aware of changes in the curriculum which were affecting the position of history at all?
No, I don't think there were any great ones. If there were, I wasn't aware of them.
Things like the development of integrated humanities and...
No, that came when I was...
Later?
Well, for me, it came later.
So in your career, how long were you at Dover then?
Till 68, and I went to Seven Oaks School, which I was head there for a couple of years.
And that was a comprehensive school?
No, that was a public school.
Ah.
That was a very unhappy experience.
Why was it unhappy?
Well, I don't know how relevant this is to your what you're writing, but it was the time when they were thinking of that the state and the independent systems could be amalgamated, integrated. And when I applied, I said that I believed in the comprehensive principle, which I'd been converted to by then, and I believed that the two systems should be integrated. Despite that, they appointed me, and it turned out almost immediately that it was impossible. You just can't do it. They're there for privilege, the independent schools. If you begin to diminish the privileges, the parents aren't prepared to pay any longer. So I was in a hopeless position, really. I left quite quickly.
And where did you go on to then?
That was the comprehensive school. I went to Weston-super-Mare, and I was head of a school called Broad Oak School, which was the bringing together of two grammar schools and a secondary modern school as a single comprehensive. It was part of a comprehensive reorganisation in Weston. And it was a very ramshackle arrangement, intended to be temporary. And in the 13 years I was there, I think we had 8 schemes of reorganisation, none of which actually took place.
Goodness.
But it was a very... that was the downside of it. And the other downsides of it were the fact we were on 2 sites and we didn't have suitable buildings, there was never enough money. And the staff, none of them had taught in a comprehensive school before, including me. But we did the best we could. And I think very strongly that the comprehensive principle is the right one. And I had to put my teaching where my opinions were, so to speak.
How had you come to that conclusion during your period in teaching in the two grammar schools?
Well, I came to that conclusion purely on Christian grounds. If you think all children are of equal value, then you shouldn't make artificial distinctions amongst them. And if you think all children are unique, you shouldn't think you can categorise them. You ought to have a system which treats all children according to their needs and allows for the fact that their needs differ infinitely, and that comprehensive school is the nearest you can get to that. But I have to say that this created a huge tension because my heart has always been a grammar school heart. It's just my head and my spirit that are comprehensive.
So what were the challenges that you and your staff had to face in creating this new comprehensive school and adapting to this wide range of ability?
Well, the challenges were infinite, but as far as the topic we're talking about this morning, yeah. We decided that, at least I think I decided, that the first 2 years in the school, what really mattered was the maximum amount of pastoral care, because everybody, at that age, I don't know if you remember, but everybody said about comprehensive schools, they are too big. I mean, some of them were as big as Eton, so you see, they must have been far too big.
How big was Broad Oak?
It was 1,800 at its largest. And they said the children would get lost, no one will know them. So what I wanted to do was to produce teaching situations where the children met the same teachers frequently. So in the first 2 years, we had what we called humanities. We parcelled up RE, history and geography into humanities, had a head of humanities, and that meant that we had to provide resources for the staff, and that's where we started using resources as opposed to textbooks. And the resources were mostly worksheets, of course.
This is the early 70s.
This is the early 70s, yes. And we used visual aids to some extent, but it was a corporate effort, and people had to teach to material which their colleagues provided. They hated it, a lot of them.
Yes, I was going to say, how did they respond to having to use worksheets? Did some of them just leave them on one side and not use them?
No, I don't think so. I think, if anything, they relied on them too much, because I was asking geographers to teach history and historians to teach geography, and it was, and all of them to teach RE, and that was a terrible, terrible thing to do. But they were a very obedient lot, I suppose I can say.
They did it.
Well, you see, none of us really knew what to do in a comprehensive situation, and I had some ideas, even if they weren't good ones.
Where had you got your ideas from?
Thinking.
Not
really.
From other people who'd tried them out?
I'd done a lot of gossiping with other people, and during the months before the school opened, I went to see heads of other comprehensive schools in the area. But the whole thing was done in a terrible rush for various reasons. The first time they advertised the headship for Broad Oak, it was in the primary section of the Times Educational Supplement, so nobody saw it. And by the time, you were supposed to have a year to get ready, but in fact I only had from January to September. So I had a lot of decisions had to be made very quickly, and I think the staff were so much distressed, worried about the whole thing, that they were quite happy to go along with my ideas.
And some had come from the grammar schools and some from the secondary model.
That's right, yes.
Did you find that difficult, putting those two...
Basically what happened was that the senior staff in the secondary modern school became pastoral senior staff in the new school, and the heads of department in the grammar schools became heads of department in the new school. That's how we did it. But it was a question of fitting everybody in. I even had to fit in a head of a school that had been closed to elsewhere in the town, and who was very resentful, of course, of the whole business. But I mean, I had to find a job for everybody, and I just had to do the best I could.
So a lot of tensions at the start, really?
Yes, a lot of tensions, a lot of tensions, and they never entirely went away, I don't think.
When you delivered the humanities course, did you get any impression about how well the children had coped with it?
I thought it went reasonably well, actually. We had one or two quite good heads of humanities while I was there. A couple of very able people looked after it. And my impression is that it went quite well. And it did have this advantage that it disrupted people's teaching habits, which were much more suitable in the past for perhaps for grammar schools, or, you know. And they had to work from the worksheets and the activity sheets that we gave them. And I think that probably improved the quality of teaching. Mm-hmm. Though, of course, the teachers weren't as expert in the material as they would have been had it been single subject.
And in the history part of it, can you remember whether you altered the sort of topics that children were studying?
Oh, yes, we did. I can't remember what all the topics were. The only one I can remember is that we did the slave trade, because that was the one bit of it I wrote for them. And I think that we took topics that we thought would be of interest to small children, to the 11s and 12s, and put those into the mix.
And then in the third year, they did a more conventional...
They did conventional history, and then in the fourth year, history was an option.
And what proportion were taking history, can you remember?
I can't remember, but it was a high proportion.
So it was a choice between history and geography?
I can't remember, sorry.
It's okay. Can you remember how the CSE and O-level issue was resolved? How was that organised in the school?
We had I can't remember the proportions, but we had history, we had O-level sets and CSE sets.
And that decision was made at the end of the third year?
It must have been, yes.
Yes. Did it bother you at all that you were making this decision between different groups of children at that stage, given your views about you know, the equality of access, if you like?
Well, no, not particularly, because my view was that within the comprehensive school you would have varying ranges of ability, and the setting was perfectly appropriate. What we tried to do was to have mixed ability teaching. Humanities was taught in mixed ability groups, apart from the very slow learners who were taken out into a separate group. And then as we went up the school, all the subjects tended to become setted.
And then did you have a group of children who didn't make it into either O-level or CSE, that weren't capable of going into either group?
That was my most traumatic experience at Broadoak School. After I'd been there for a few years, I thought I must teach the slow learners, because everybody says how appallingly difficult they are, and how it's quite impossible to teach them unless you're a specialist. So I thought I'd take on a couple of slow learner groups. And I found it absolutely awful at first. I didn't know how to tackle them. And I think one of the things I was proudest of was that by the time I'd finished, I did know how to teach them something. Whether they retained it or not is another matter. But I found that the thing you had to do was to have a new activity roughly every 5 or 10 minutes, and jump from one thing to another, have sanctions which could be applied very quickly and easily, and plus points which could be acquired very easily. And if you did that, you could get them to cooperate with you. Well, how much they learned, I wasn't sure.
But they still learned some history, presumably.
Their little history, yes. I mixed all sorts of things up, local history and national history, and a bit of map work and that kind of thing.
Talking about national history, do you think that it is important for children to have a sense of national identity through the teaching of history, a national narrative?
It's one good thing you can get from history teaching, I would say. I wouldn't necessarily say that it's as important as the sort of thing that Christopher's been doing with his classes, which identifies them with what's happened in the past much more fully, I think, than the kind of teaching I did.
You mean the use of sources and investigations?
Use of sources and investigations, and using the internet, and doing things other than political and military history. I think all that I think the advantages of that are so great that the fact you lose a national narrative by comparison is not that important. But I think, given an ideal world, you would include the national narrative as part of the mix. But I don't know if that can be done, really.
I realised you mentioned English history quite a lot, English history and European history. Were you feeling it was English history rather than British history you were teaching?
Oh yes, definitely yes. These Celts, really, one didn't have much time for them except to be beaten by the English occasionally. That's exaggerating a bit, but yeah, not very much.
Do you think it mattered whether you were teaching in chronological order?
Oh, I used to feel very strongly about that, yes. I used to think that I was a national narrative person when I was teaching history, and as you say, we used to teach chronologically, and it was only with some daring that we ventured outside English and European history and the national chronology. But I now see the weaknesses of that approach, and I think that the modern approach overall is a better one.
Why?
Because it's nearer to what life is like. I mean, if you do something like the Holocaust or the history of medicine or something like that, with original sources and lots of illustrations and so on, you're actually teaching children something unfamiliar about how human beings are and behave, which might enrich their own lives in a way that I don't think learning dates of kings and battles does. I mean, you can find plenty of people who regard their years at school and history teaching as absolutely dreary and wasted. My wife was one of them, actually.
But she'd never been taught by you.
Well, no, I used to console myself with that thought, yes.
Essentially, though, when you were saying about how you tried to get students to think about things, you were asking them to think about life and about issues through history.
Yes.
And it's just a different way of using the historical material, isn't it?
Yes. You see, really, I'm happiest when I teach the very able pupil. And that's another of the agonies that my being committed to comprehensive education gave me. The lessons I enjoyed above all were the scholarship lessons with third year sixth formers, when we were talking in general terms about life and everything, and when we were talking about political philosophy and that kind of thing. And I think that the sort of history I taught is a very good sort of history for very able boys, or girls too. But I don't think that it's the very right sort of history for most children.
You mentioned teaching the slave trade when you were at Western, which is in the West Country, and that sort of presumably was a topic you felt was locally relevant as well as important.
That wasn't the reason I taught it. No, I taught it because I thought it was something that they'd find interesting.
Why particularly?
Because it's got some sort of nasty ghoulish bits to it. Children like that. I can still remember that part of the course was that we constructed the amount, using desks and so on, the amount of space that a slave would have, and we made them all go into the space, you know, which in those days was a really very advanced sort of teaching to do, you know. Not they do it without any hesitation nowadays, but we chose the topics that we did in the first 2 years solely, I think, with the sense of their attractiveness to young people, really, to get them excited about the subjects.
Did you also feel that a subject like that was important for them to know about, to teach them about tolerance and about, if you like, the crimes of the past and how we needed to avoid them?
Well, certainly not with the younger ones, that wasn't. I don't think the moral aspects of talking about the past bulked very large. It's worth remembering, of course, that most history stopped long before the crimes of the 20th century. And I suppose we didn't say anything to in praise of the slave trade, but I think we let its moral obscenity speak for itself, really. One of the things that's improved enormously is how recently history comes up to now. I mean, Christopher spent much of his life teaching the Second World War. When I was at Oxford, the history syllabus stopped at 1870. And I never got much beyond the end of the First World War in my own teaching.
So when you were talking about the 19th and 20th century O-level syllabus at Lancaster, you meant up to 1914?
Yes, I don't think we even did the First World War. We certainly didn't do the periods between the wars.
Why was that? Why do you think that people didn't?
I don't think that. I'm not even sure if the syllabus at that stage went that far.
Possibly not.
I can't remember. But
so it was something that you were receiving as a school, that basically it just was assumed you didn't teach history of the very recent past.
Very recent history, yes. That wasn't taught, I don't think, anywhere really.
Recent trends in the school curriculum seem to be sort of squeezing the time available for history in some schools. But when you were teaching, or when you were ahead, was history a highly rated subject?
I think it was taken as a standard subject. I mean, it was quite a radical decision not to teach it to make it an option at GCSE. I mean, there weren't nearly so many subjects around in those days. And I think history was an established central part of the curriculum, but I wouldn't say that that meant that it was well taught or anything like that.
When you, in your later career, did you feel that history was becoming diminished in importance because of the growth of new subjects?
No, that didn't happen during my time. I mean, the new subjects nearly all came in after I retired.
When were you retiring?
1984.
That's before the national curriculum as well. So
yes.
During your whole career, you were able to choose.
We were able to choose what we did. Yes.
Yes.
The enchanted garden of the curriculum, the sacred garden that even the inspectors didn't dare comment on. That was the.
You mentioned the general inspection. I was wondering what actually happened when you had a general inspection at that time.
The only general inspection I was involved in was in Lancaster. And that just involved a nice, modest, quiet man coming and sitting in the back of a few lessons and giving me a very laudatory comment. That was all it involved. I don't know what went on, but I know that they condemned school dinners very strongly. But that's all I remember of it, really. It was a very civilised thing in those days, very gentle.
And did the local authority have any impact on what was happening in the school, curriculum-wise?
It didn't in my earlier schools at all. When I came to Weston, I found that there had been an attempt by the local authority to introduce a new form of French teaching, which had created absolute chaos within the schools, because the head of the girls' grammar school, previous head of the girls' grammar school, liked it, but none of the French staff did. And I think occasionally the enthusiasms of the local authority inspectors had an impact on bits of the curriculum, but on the whole it was left to you what you did and didn't do.
Were there any other influences on members of staff in terms of historical association or, you know, leading ideas affecting the way people chose the topics they taught or the way they taught?
Not that I'm aware of, really, no. No. I mean, I think that most of the history teachers for most of my career were quite content to plough and accustomed to furrow, put it that way.
And is that something that, as a head, you found frustrating or just accepted?
I think probably for most of my career, I took the view, which I think was the common view at that time, that it was the subject department's job to decide how to teach the subject. And it was only in special circumstances, like with the introduction of humanities, for example, that you should interfere with their decisions. I think that was the view I took.
And that was the case even if the exam results weren't too good?
Oh no, if the exam results weren't too good, you asked some questions. But even there, you see, when I look at schools now and compare it with Broadoak, which is my last school, we did in a sort of way almost everything that's done now in the way of checking up, but it was infinitely more gentle. And there wasn't the punch behind it. It was very, very difficult to get rid of teachers. And it wasn't expected that you would be peremptory with people who were failing. And of course, it's also partly a function of personality. I suppose I'd rather encourage people than condemn them.
Finally, if you could choose any historical topic to teach, what would it be and to what age group? This is your fantasy history lesson.
Well, I suppose the people I would like to teach are a group of very, very clever sixth formers, and I'd like to teach them about the Revolutionary Napoleonic Wars, probably.
Do you think that they would learn more from that than almost any other historical topic, or it's simply that you really enjoy it?
It reflects my own career, really. I am sure there are lots of things that are much more valuable. But you did ask about enjoyment and not about doing what was best for the young people.
Thank you very much.